Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotech Corporation, creators of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Locke.
Welcome to Serotalk. Podcast number 47 for August 2nd, 2010. This is Michael Loff.
I'm Ricky Anger.
And I'm Joe Steinkamp.
Now, sometime when I want to edit for 2 days, I'll bring in Mikey and we'll be the Fab Four. Welcome, everyone. We got a lot of stuff. We didn't cover news 2 weeks ago. Not a lot happened, though, during the conventions, I guess, other than the release of the Audible app for the iPhone, which was kind of cool. And I think Ricky played with it. You can download any books you've already purchased. You just can't buy new books.
It came out on a day when I fried my SD card and was heading back home on a 6-hour plane ride and wasn't going to have anything to read. Luckily, the Audible app had come out that day. I was able to use my machine to purchase what I wanted, and I was able to download the book without using iTunes. And to me, that's a very big advantage because sometimes you just aren't at the machine where you have iTunes configured for your device. So was able to do that. I listened at normal speed. It appears there's not a way to speed that up, but otherwise the app is quite nice.
Yeah, they did just change the Audible front-end interface late last week, but I did test, and yes, System Access, and to my knowledge, still is the only screen reader that lets you listen to the audio samples. It lets you access that necessary button to hear the sample of the book before you purchase. As far as speed, there's a new podcasting client, used to be called RSS Reader or something like that. Now it's called Podcaster, and that one you can actually speed up, and you can even add OPML so you can import all your favorite podcasts. A lot of cool stuff there. Also in the newness category, Pat Ferguson just posted a review of the new Olympus DM4. It's a digital recorder that does WAV, WMA, and MP3, and also is a DAISY player, at least for some types of DAISY content. It does not do the NLS books, and according to her review, the claims of voice or speech recognition are a little bit exaggerated because you do have to buy some other software to make that happen, but you can check that out. It's over at blindcooltech.com, and of course, all links available at serotalk.com. We also posted some new links to a lot of Office 2010 content. Microsoft and some third parties have been busy producing some good stuff, so they have it in both the DOCX format for Word, the XPS, as well as PDFs. So take your pick. We got links to all that cool stuff for you.
That's always changing. When they do that, it always seems like it should be tied around the release of Office. It generally isn't. But what can happen is that they can remove stuff too. As service packs come out, as patches come out, Microsoft is famous for actually changing their help files and changing some of the training files. So if you go to Microsoft.com/training or some of those other areas, you will notice that the content is there. May not be there like a year from now. Some of the materials that we used in trainings that I've done in the past here in Texas actually aren't available anymore. They've removed them from the website. So grab those while you can, because they can always change.
Any links that we provide, just with the internet in general, with 1% of it changing every week, when someone gives you a link to something cool, you want to go ahead and grab and don't think, well, I'll go back in a few months because it may not be there. Interesting post I saw this morning talking about many libraries are actually overall renting more movies than even your popular services like Netflix, but something that many people may not be aware of is many libraries also rent described movies, not only in DVD, but also VHS. Do either of you still have working VHS players? Mine is dead.
I think it's in a closet somewhere. I have to think about that.
And I'm not telling you to, as some of our folks in the chat room have said, they live by the burn and return policy, but just so you're mindful that libraries can be a great resource to get DVS content. Even if they don't have it, maybe help you figure out where this stuff resides if you want to buy DVS movies. We can't do a show without talking about some Apple stuff. It just doesn't happen. But three recent posts, all from Apple Insider. First, Apple is suing manufacturers of what they call inferior quality products for the iPod and iPhone, in particular the accessories. They've named six companies specifically and say there may be another 20 involved. And I think Joe and I might have opposite views on this, because I'm of the take that they have the right to control if someone is producing products that don't work with their technology and therefore give the Apple products a bad name. Whereas I think, Joe, you're more of the feeling that if it weren't for the third parties, Apple would be nothing, right?
You have to think that Apple, for the longest time, through things like Macworld and WWDC, relied on the third-party communities to really bring more to the platform. And it seems a little bit like biting the hand that feeds you to come around and say, hey, you know, that USB cup warmer you came out with, that's not exactly what we need in representative, and it may not be as reliable as we need you to be. And I can understand it from the brand perspective, because when you join into the Apple Collective, you are buying into an experience both on the hardware and the software side for user experience. And so I get where Apple's going here, but at the same time, Microsoft and Sony have done this too, Nintendo to a greater degree in the video game space, and it has actually caused some duress, because there are some brands that you might not realize that people will find beloved. It's really an interesting move by Apple to start cracking down on these individuals. We'll see how that affects the developers.
Here's one I knew is just a question of when. Apple removes competitor phones from their antenna page. Said, hey, our phones aren't that bad. Look at all these other phones, and showed specific models from manufacturers and said, hey, they have issues with if you put your hand in the wrong place, of degraded performance as well. Those have been removed. No competing company in their right mind is going to let your competitor post negative things about you without the legal beagles getting involved.
I think that's also another situation where you saw a lot of things out of the UK and other media markets where they weren't allowed to use Apple phones in their ads. And so this seems to be more of a leveling of the playing field, because Apple can't use those guys, so they can't use Apple's.
Last week, the U.S. Library of Congress said it is okay. It is even legal to jailbreak your phone, and by that meaning altering it to run third-party applications that Apple may not approve. Well, we've already seen one for iOS 4. Hackers have released a tool that you can actually use to jailbreak the phone. However, this one's unique because it's actually done through the browser. You actually go into Safari to accomplish this. However, they've already found that it breaks FaceTime and who knows what else. So again, the great point that Joe made and some others made the other night in our Tech Chat 66, which I would encourage folks to listen to if you're curious about our 8 cents on the iPhone 4, this concept that, you know, if you jailbreak, you're also breaking accessibility in many ways, because these third-party apps are not written in the same language. While it sounds cool, it may not be for us the best opportunity, although I do know some blind folks who have done it and lived that way for a while and ran their phones on T-Mobile. And
people were jailbreaking their phones to be able to do tethering, but they weren't doing so much for the apps that they couldn't get in the App Store. So it may not be even worth it to do that for many of us.
Yeah, there was
they demonstrated it on Twit the other night. I was watching the live stream, and they actually went to jailbreak me and demonstrated how to do it. And it doesn't take all that long. And when it comes back up, it gives you the three options of, are you a general user? Are you a hacker? Or are you a developer? It replaces the App Store with a secondary store, or at least it makes the secondary store the main store, and you have to go a different way to get to the App Store. So if you're thinking about this, you really might want to go watch that Twit episode, which I think is 259, because they demonstrate that, and they talk about the ups and downs of doing this as they're breaking Brian Brushwood's phone, which is pretty cool. Maybe there's some apps out there that have not gone through the Apple approval process, or there's something that would never get through the Apple approval process. This isn't for the faint of heart, and of course it's going to violate your terms of service, and there's no promise that Apple won't turn around and do an update that may cause some problems to your phone as well. So Leo did try it on the iPad, and it just continuously rebooted his iPad. It's definitely something that's for iPhones, and it's something that you always might want to give yourself a week, 3 weeks, a month, and see how others do it before you run right out and be that first adopter.
Well, there is more in the world than Apple, so let's talk about some other phone-related stuff. First, in the broadband space, a company called SkyTerra, they're coming out with something called Light Squared Broadband. And it's interesting because this is going to be sold by many providers, depending upon the licensing, maybe even folks like Best Buy. So basically, you get a satellite-based form of broadband that you can get for your devices. However, they've excluded AT&T and Verizon and said, you have too large of a market share. You can't sell this product, so wait for the lawsuits to begin with that technology as it rolls out over the next few years. Up to 4.6 million Android users may have had their data compromised in an app.
Custom wallpaper app, I believe.
Anywhere from 1 to 4.5 million users' data was sent to a server in China. And the article said, well, this may not be such a big deal. I'm sorry, I disagree with you. I mean, anytime we're talking in the millions of personal users' information gets sent to a server in China, nothing against our fine friends in China, but that's just not a good thing. I don't see how that could or should be taken lightly, and goes back to the whole argument of the trade-offs versus Android that is open and allows more flexibility, but also maybe greater potential for problems, but as opposed to a closed environment, which certainly also has its own issues, but something where a company can try to lock down some of those issues.
They did an analysis which said that Apple products, which are far more closed, they still had these types of issues, but I think it was about 15% less often than on the Android platform. And the article was interesting because it starts out saying that some extremely personal information, such as your voicemail password and your SMS messages and some other things, got sent to this server. And it turns out that no, those things weren't sent. Nevertheless, there was some information sent. And when you download a wallpaper app, you don't really expect any personal information to be sent anywhere. So in that respect, it is a big deal.
It's a sign of maturity. We've been through this before. We've seen this with screensavers. We've seen this in the Windows world forever. The social hacks are the best. So whenever you're wanting to get a mass number of people, you do something viral or you find something that's going to work. The problem is that the user doesn't always pay attention to where these programs come from. When looking at something like a screensaver or a wallpaper app or something like that, you always have to think, where is this coming from? Again, we're getting back to Michael's point about the App Store and how important it is that Apple go through the process of verifying who this is, where the program is coming from, and they're doing their level best in order to make sure that an attack like this doesn't happen necessarily in the iOS platform. In Android, there's a little bit more of a frontier spirit. It's a geekier platform as well. So until it has some of the checks and balances that some of the other platforms have, we're going to see things just like this, where you're going to download something and it's going to hit a bunch of people. Some of these animated apps really destroy your battery because it's always something going on in the background.
What would you say then to the users on this Android platform? Because there isn't a surefire way to be careful about where you get your apps. You can't depend on name brands. If we're on the Windows side and we're talking about software, you might go and see something that CNET has reviewed and purchase the software based on that. But for Android, there's just a bunch of apps in the store, and you don't expect any sort of name brand people. Everyone is little known developer until people have a reputation to go on, and or until there are more checks and balances. What do you say to these users except, well, it may happen?
Well, the article made the great point of, first off, reading the not so exciting terms of service, because if a company's forthright about saying we're going to collect and possibly use with third parties, share with third parties personal information, and you don't read that and you go ahead and click and approve the app, that's part of it. Now, it's certainly a whole secondary issue when it's malicious and you don't know it's happening.
Apple, the way that the App Store works is very much an impulse buy. I'm walking out of the grocery store, there's some gum over there, I'm going to get it philosophy. The rating system, good or bad, because there are some developers who don't like that at all, at least there's comments, there's a way of kind of following up. And the community kind of polices itself. When there's been bad apps or malicious apps, or I'm thinking of the I'm Rich app, the $999 app, that didn't take long to go out of the store. There are ideas where the community steps in and does what it needs to do. And Android, again, it's a large community, but it's still growing and it's still kind of finding its feet. You know, the Apple App Store has been around for more than 3 years. We're just entering kind of maybe the 18-month, almost two-year phase for Android. And it's going to be an interesting move to find those big name players. Certainly in the gaming space, that's there. But in these third-party applications, it is pretty much, I don't want to use the term crapshoot, but that really is where we are at the moment.
An interesting article I read at Wired magazine called Bad Connection Inside the iPhone Network Meltdown. There's been a lot of blame for well over 3 years, AT&T and Apple fighting back and forth, and it provides some good insight for those trying to understand the complexities of it and want to just blame AT&T. As I always say, there's a minimum of two sides to every story, and I thought it was a very interesting read, so you might want to check that out. KNFB Reader 6.4.1 adds support for two new Nokia phones.
The phones are the C5 and the 6700. And what's interesting to me is that one of these phones only has a 3.2 megapixel camera, which is exactly like that you would find on an iPhone, except I believe that the Nokia camera does have a flash, which can certainly make a lot of difference. But those two phones are now supported.
For a long time, I've heard a lot of presentations where 5 megapixels is what's needed.
5 megapixels is barely enough. You should have 8 megapixels to do this justice.
I've read that really the human eye really can't detect anything greater than 3 or 3.2. So maybe the higher number of pixels might be more helpful in color recognition.
The KNFB reader does now do color detection, I believe, right?
It not only looks at just, you know, now color, but it's also looking at whether your hand is in an X, Y, or Z axis. It looks at light and shadow. It looks at what you're looking at, if it's actually sloping away from you. Ray has done a talk about what it took to get that software there. So when we start looking at these applications of OCR, there's actually some differences between KNFB and some of these other solutions that we're seeing. So it's not just the software or the megapixel of the camera. There's a little bit more detail involved in how they do it.
Mobile Speak, they have released support for 3 new phones, the HTC HD2, the LG Insight, spelled I-N-C-I-T-E, from AT&T, as well as the LG GM750 from Vodafone.
I'm interested in the HD2 because it comes preloaded with transformers. But if you're low vision, the HD2 is a very large screen. And if you're a low vision Windows mobile user, that may be a good phone for you to look out. It's a T-Mobile phone mostly, but I've seen it on other carriers as well.
Now, Jody, want to comment on this? The FCC gives their thumbs up or approval to the first LTE phone.
I'm looking at buying a new phone. I'm on Verizon. I have this deep-seated fear that I'm going to buy something and 6 months later, this LTE phone is going to come out and it's going to be miraculous. That first adopter phase, do I really want to be the first one on the planet? The idea is that this is a little bit better than what we're dealing with EVO and what we're dealing with in other 3G/4G coverages. It's already been tested in other places. And in fact, a carrier got a provider for it just recently. It's going to be interesting because this is another one of those, you know, monikers that you're going to hear going forward. Got to go faster stripe is what we called it in retail. It'll be interesting because you'll be able to do faster speeds and more broadband stuff. But really, again, what are you trying to do with your phone is always the most important part here. So it remains to be seen what's going on with this phone and this technology, because it always takes a little bit of time for the technology to catch up with the software and the hardware.
The FCC is seeking comments on accessible mobile phone options for both blind, deafblind, and low vision. I received some emails about it saying that blind folks should get involved and put in their comments to the FCC. I don't know if either of you have ever done anything like that.
It certainly doesn't hurt to get involved. One of the dangers when doing one of these mass accessibility things is that we have to remember who we are as a disabled group and the size that we are. If there's a larger community, they can get a lion's share of the attention. Years ago, I was involved with some access issues in Houston. The disabled community who happened to ride in wheelchairs were very vocal, and they staged a demonstration by going down to Houston and blocking the Metro building with their wheelchairs about 5 people deep so nobody could actually get in. And when we went to go get a bunch of blind guys to go down there, we were nowhere near as successful. And what ended up happening was the wheelchair community ended up taking a lot of access board spots. And so I'm always kind of cautious about these melting pot situations, because the larger population can be the more dominant. And I'm afraid that if we don't get involved, if we don't involve ourselves in these actions when they come up, then we might be left out. So we definitely want to have an opportunity if there is an opportunity. And we definitely want to be vocal. We also want to be polite and also remember that there's going to be other people in the room as well. And we have to acknowledge their issues as well.
How to do this is one thing to say you should do it. And a lot of people just want some insight. They want to see at least one written letter or email. Hopefully they won't copy it verbatim, but just to get an idea of how you submit comments like this, and then you add your own personal touch to it. President Obama has issued an executive order to increase the number of persons with disabilities working for the federal government. At the ACB convention, there were 2 rooms, and I don't know how many people knew this, because the second one was pretty dead. Most people didn't even know that it existed, but it had folks like the IRS, Department of Justice, Social Security, and I think the guide dog schools, and maybe a couple other nonprofits in there. But I spoke with the woman from Social Security. I said, are you offering information here for folks who might like to work for your organization? And she said, well, it's interesting. I've had about 80 requests for that. We're here just to talk about benefits. Again, there are folks wanting to work and wanting to know how to get into the federal maze, but even she said, even as a sighted person, it's a very convoluted convoluted process. It is different for each agency that you go to. I'm just curious if you and your work in Texas assisted anyone and have any suggestions of how people even get into that system.
Well, she's absolutely right. Everybody kind of goes at it in a weird kind of way. And by that, I mean, it's very much federally regulated. That part is true. But going to each agency and you submit to this one here and you submit to that one there and finding out which one to submit to is kind of daunting. You know, do I do this under Section A? Do I do this under another area? And then when you're going through and having things sorted, one of the reasons why you want to declare that you have a disability is that that kind of moves you up in the way that they approach the applications. Veterans Administration also gets preference, and there's some other people within the category of Section A that are able to be kind of not screened first. They have an ability to be viewed on a different level than, say, someone who is, for Harry Potter terms, a muggle, a normal, in order to go in and apply. Doing a lot of research can help, but there is a lot of federal job bank / job placement. You know, there's a lot of job fairs that the federal government puts on as well. There was one just recently in April that was nothing but online job fairs. If you're not working with a vocational counselor in a rehab program, you might want to just go ahead to the website itself, look at the federal hiring policies, network if you know anybody who's already inside a federal organization that can kind of give you an idea of how to understand all the different monetary tracks as in G12, G14, and things like that. I would avoid things like Wikipedia. That can't necessarily be your friend. I have met people who've gone and done research there. Actually doing some basic interviewing skills.
People I know who worked in at least a Social Security Administration said they had a lot of problems, a lot of browbeating and being put down by supervisors who really didn't want them there. Have you seen that where people got into it, landed the gig, and within a year or two or three had to move on because it was just psychologically problematic for them?
I can see how the amount of work can get to somebody. You know, when you do a job, you think, okay, I can accomplish this. I'm 75% done. I'm 90% done. Let's take, for instance, when I was doing vocational rehabilitation. When you were doing something like that, there's no physical end to that. And so if you're in the Social Security Administration, there's always going to be someone there that needs some assistance. There's no real down period. There's no cycle. If you're with the IRS, you have kind of a moment of expectation that you won't be able to take off vacation in April. So there's kind of a moment of getting used to the organization, its cycles, and what works within that organization. And of course, when you join in, some of these probationary periods are like 2 years. I've met people who've gone through the IRS program and they have to work for 2 years to get off of probation. That's not unheard of either. When you're going through the interviewing process, make sure to ask that. If you can meet other employees that are going to lunch, or maybe you can run into somebody who knows a friend, kind of knowing that going in about the position is very helpful because that way you have some expectations of what you're going into. And also, a lot of these organizations are already using a screen reader or they're already scripted for a screen reader. So if your platform is not necessarily a dominant one, you might want to prepare yourself for that as well, because being able to know your hotkeys for Word, Internet Explorer, Outlook, and your screen reader of choice's hotkeys is what's really going to help you get off the mark and do really well. I can tell you a number of times I've seen people panic and have to go, oh my gosh, what are my Excel keys? And have to brush up on that really quickly because they might not have ever had to go into Excel. So those are kind of job readiness skills that are very important to have, not just for federal jobs, but for any job, really.
I spoke with folks who trained other disabled employees on a federal level and said there were some that just had no initiative, that they just didn't want to learn and do the things they had to do, or maybe they were just overwhelmed and blinded by the headlights like a deer in the road or something.
Sometimes I think it really is a case of someone wanting to work because that looks good on paper and those are the expectations, and then getting there. And I mean, let's just be honest, there is a mindset among some people, unfortunately, where they say, okay, I'm here, I'm working, I am employed, but wait, you mean I have to do something while I'm here? I didn't know that was part of the plan.
Or maybe they're trying to get their seven quarters in to collect Social Security. I've seen that as well.
That is very possible.
If you want to get some really good skills, volunteering is very important. If you're really trying to work in an office environment, find some offices, the Red Cross or other organizations that are always in need of volunteers to kind of get you into that mindset, to get you into the lingo, to get you into, hey, this is what it's like to work in a cube. I have to remember, you know, that I can't store a bunch in my cube, or I need to be able to have the computer on the desk so my guide dog fits better under the desk. These are things that sometimes you can't tackle until you're on the job site, but doing some volunteer work can always help you in that area. And it's also a great resource for networking. Even if it's just going to the church and helping out the church, there are lots of opportunities, if you think about it, that are nearby that can involve you in a positive outcome for employment. And the good thing is there's always a need for volunteers. It's always a situation where when you're going for something that's more paid, the expectations change, and certainly the amount of work that you have to do could change, but having some experience as a blind individual entering the world of employment can do you a world of good, especially when you land that job that you really want.
I would agree with that. Volunteer is a great way to get your own skills up to speed and just learn what it's like to work as a team to accomplish projects and dealing with people who have different personality types than yourself. I would agree 100% with that. The House approves H.R. 3101. Of course, we talked about this earlier, internet access and Bill of Rights for people with disabilities. A pretty high vote here, 278 to 23. So the first thing I'm looking at when I see that number is, wait a minute, that's nowhere near 435. Where's everyone else? It was interesting. It was done on July 26, which marked the 20th anniversary of the ADA. It kind of looked like to me, I don't mean to be a cynic, yes I do, that it was really a buy for votes. I mean, here, 50 million people, look here what we're doing for you. And we're pretty much unanimous on our vote. Did any of you have thoughts of this? Did any of you look at it that way and kind of think, wow, yeah, we're going to vote for this, get the 50 million votes, and maybe we're not overly concerned with exactly what's included, or does it matter because we can always change it later? Or am I just the only cynic in the house?
Well, November is just a few months away. For many, that's a big time for going back to their constituents. And it certainly wouldn't look very good in front of the press if a large group of individuals of many disabilities stood up and said, how could you not vote for this, along with all the other stuff you didn't do? I would rather that the free market always decide the best thing for itself rather than government legislation get involved, because someone who worked for the government for 10 years, usually our answers are not the best. I think this is a road paved with great intentions, but I'm not exactly sure what comes out of this either, because look, we've got the do not call list. And how many telemarketers pay attention to that? This is going to be a very interesting thing going forward on what this actually means, because I don't want it to be a law that's just there on paper either.
Input is currently being sought on changes to U.S. currency. Now, we already talked about in a previous podcast that next year there will be a $100 bill with some actually embedded ground glass that they think folks will be able to feel. But this will also involve, A, some larger numerals. But the thing that intrigued me is actually loaning people money identifying hardware. Actually, you know, whether it's an iBill or some other piece of technology that you would basically prove that you cannot read the denominations and actually get something from the government to help you determine your notes.
Whenever this debate comes up, our listeners from other countries are probably snickering because they're saying, we've never had to deal with this. Bless your hearts in the U.S.
Right. Either they have systems like in Australia, the notes are different sizes and they just have like a ruler, so to speak, that they put the bill in there and it tells them, you know, by where it comes out in the markings, what denomination it is. You know, and Canadian has braille money. Of course, my thought with putting any kind of tactile marking on it is eventually it's going to be rubbed out. I mean, it's going to go through so many hands.
But not only that, but I don't think that's true accessibility. Yes, it is braille, but what about those people who have gotten blinded later in life, or they have some neuropathy issues or whatever, where braille is not the answer for them? It's kind of interesting to try and come up with a solution that works well for everyone.
You really shot me down with the neuropathy, because I was like, what a great way to force people to learn braille. And you shot me down again.
Hey, I'm all for anything that'll force people to learn braille, because I think it's exceedingly useful and it's not obsolete and something that's no longer needed or anything like that. But there are some cases where it's just not plausible to do that.
you know, working with people in Randolph Shepard and other business enterprise programs, they remind me of, well, do I have to change out everything in the vending machine? And because that's what a lot of those guys do is vending machine applications. To them, they're kind of caught between they want accessibility, but they also don't want to have to replace all the money identifiers in their machines as well. So, you know, again, we're back to that unintended consequences thing where you do one thing, but you're not sure exactly who you're actually affecting. And sometimes when you talk about changing money, it can affect a large number of people, including ATMs and the track readers and rolling things through.
That's why I always thought free iBill or some kind of money identifier, but the whole handout versus a hand.
And if they change the format, do they have to go back and hand everybody else a new one? I mean,
exactly. You know, do they have any kind of hardware upgrades? Like the iBill does not. If they really change the currency, we got these cool iBills and they're awesome and they work great now. But if they change the currency enough, it's not going to work. And
there's
going
to be a flood of iBills winging their way across to the manufacturing plant to get chip replacements.
Are you saying that there's a landfill right now full of record players that play 78 speed flexi discs or a large landfill full of APH four-track recorders? Is that what you're saying? That's always my danger, too, is with counterfeiting and all the changes that can happen to money. Is there literally a service center where you come in and program that iBill or what have you to get updated and here's the new thing to be able to identify this year's new money? It's like catching sand in a colander.
Well, let's look at some grassroots advocacy. And first, let me read, or paraphrase anyway, a letter I received, email from Ron McHugh. And of course, you can always contact us, resources@serotalk.com, or call the Blab line at 866-997-2522. But he says, hey, I have two particular apps that I'd like to see accessible for the iPhone, but I don't really know how to approach them. Just simply asking for access doesn't seem like it would go very far. Do you have any suggestions on how to approach this? One thing that we're going to post here. Buddy Brannon wrote to Amazon and asked, will the next generation of the Kindles be fully accessible? Will we be able to navigate the menus? And he did actually get a response from Amazon. Not quite what we hoped for, but he did get a response. So you can read his letter and his response. A few that I've done, in particular because he mentions iPhone apps, basically it was something to the point of, you know, my name is Michael Loff. I'm writing on behalf of the thousands of persons who are blind, who have low vision, who would like to use Application X, but currently it is inaccessible. However, correcting this may be a very simple process of labeling some buttons and icons. And here's a great resource from Apple, HTTP, whatever, whatever. And I post that URL in there and say, I'd be willing to work with you and beta test it. And I have used an upper hand to say, if you have something to show, you know, we'll help you let people know of its existence through social networking and, you know, kind of throw that out there. And I've had some pretty good luck with that. So what thoughts do you have with someone just saying, hey, I want to approach someone and ask them to make this little piece of software, be it an iPhone app or a Windows program accessible?
I think the key is that you have to do a little bit of education, because if you say, hello, I'm blind, and there are lots of other people who are blind who want to use this application as well, and if you make it accessible, that'd be great and we'll all buy it. That is essentially what you want, but for a lot of people, they don't understand what accessibility is and they don't know what types of resources are available, whether it's developing for an Apple app or if it's something on the Windows platform or whatever. They don't know where they would even begin to get started as far as learning what accessibility is and then going through the process of making their own apps accessible. So you have to provide, as you said, Michael, something like providing the link to the Apple accessibility guidelines, or if you're working on the Windows platform and you're writing to a web designer, you can point them at SA2Go where they can do some accessibility testing and even offer your own expertise. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have about making this accessible and then just reiterate the sort of buttering them up. So many people have told me that this app is incredible and I want to experience it for myself. Let them know that you believe they have a worthy product and they can make it even better by doing a couple of things.
And I don't know how many others have experienced this, but I got hit with a questionnaire that said, how large of a market? How many people are we talking about? 5 or 6 questions, but they required a little bit of research. What's the potential market? What percentage of them do you think will buy the product? I mean, I have no way of knowing how to answer that. So what do? Do I make up stats or do I politically dance around the question? Well, I can give them a number of their potential market, but that took a little research to do that. So just be mindful that you might get questions like that. I mean, most people I talked to just said they basically contacted the developer. They gave them that link. Many times they came back and said, wow, it's cool. It was as simple as, I didn't realize blind folks used my product. And they go ahead and put one out and they see some sales as a result, or at least they see that people followed through and posted it on their Twitter and Facebook pages and were serious about promoting the efforts. I think because so few people take time to contact developers that we have an upper hand there. I mean, when I worked in radio, I was excited if I got a letter from a prisoner, because at least I got some physical correspondence other than, could you pay New Kids on the Block on the phone? You know what I mean?
That's
so you,
right.
you had something tangible that someone took the time and actually wanted to communicate with you.
It's only when they said, hey, Michael, I'm out in 3 years. Let's party. What I think is important is user stories. Let's say Amazon, for instance. I've been a customer of Amazon for blank, or my mother uses Amazon all the time, and I'm really intrigued because I believe this will do the following. It's important to relay it back to the individuals. Sometimes some of these larger organizations are getting inundated with requests for all sorts of services all the time. So bringing it back to the importance of, I want to be your customer, or this is my experience previously being your customer, and now it is no longer the issue where I can do it in, you know, this application. That's important to an organization, because the greatest way to get your foot in the door with any organization, like Michael was just saying a second ago, is to ask. And asking those developers to talk more about themselves will give you the opportunity to slide accessibility into the conversation without it feeling more like a hammer in an anvil situation. And that's really the idea here, is you don't want to force this down their throat. You want them to kind of come to the understanding that this is just the right thing to do.
Petitions sound like a great idea, and 10,000 signatures looks impressive, but it's going to take more time and perhaps really tug on the heartstrings that it's going to really take to make it happen, to have 100 personally, individually crafted emails or physical letters that someone explains their personal experience. I bought products for Amazon. Now I'm going to college. Before I graduate, I know all of these textbooks are going to be in a digital format, and a physical hardcover book's not even going to be an option. And I hope we can work together to make sure that I and my fellow college students will be able to seamlessly pursue higher education.
Yeah, make it personal. A form letter, like Michael's saying, can only get you so far. It's very important to have something that's unique about you. It's the same way they used to tell us in the 80s to print all your resumes on goldenrod, because it made you unique. And I thought, well, gee, if you just told 1,000
of them to do it. To everyone.
I had a friend who actually mailed a shoebox with one shoe and said, hi, I just wanted to get my foot in the door.
Nice.
I don't think he got the job, but he certainly got their attention.
I don't think I would mail anything like that to a federal job.
I'm talking radio. You know, or something where maybe a promotions company, a PR, someone who is outward facing, an ad agency, you know, how close do I want to get to this shoe?
Has this been worn? I don't know.
Well, Michael, you remember that radio promotion to mail an egg?
Yes, yes.
The Federal Postal Service got mad at that radio station. I think they even got fined for asking everybody to mail an egg to them because there was such a mess in the Postal Service.
Try it, free matter.
No.
The franking privilege.
Another initiative was started, looks like by GW Micro, asking people to write to Intuit that you want accessibility to their products. And I don't know if there's something in particular that has spawned this. Many people use that already in the workplace with varying degrees of success. That's something worth pursuing.
Freedom has talked about this on a couple of occasions. I've been in presentations where Eric has talked about how people need to write in and ask Intuit. And then Dolphin has done some success with it. Part of it is that when you tab out of a cell in some of the things, it just becomes instantly embedded and it becomes hard to get in there and read once when you've actually entered into it. And some of it's security. You know, Intuit's afraid that if they allow not just screen readers, but other API access into their products, that they'll be less secure and you'll be able to manipulate the data. So from their standpoint, they're not seeing it always as an access issue. They're looking at it as more of a app integrity issue. A company has to be, you know, you have to remind individuals that we do need these access. And how many times have you gone to convention and heard, well, we're the alternative to Intuit. And it's great that we have those community aspects. But, you know, if you're working in a large organization or even a small business, sometimes Intuit is the only thing they've got. That's what they could afford. So I think it's great, though. If GW is going to roll in this direction, I think, you know, it's worth a shot. But Intuit has not been very friendly towards these advances in the past.
But now they're going to the cloud, aren't they?
QuickBooks has gone away in a way, the same way that a lot of things like MS Money has sort of gone away in the way that it used to. And by that, I mean, QuickBooks is still around. It's just the way that you access it is a little different. MS Money is completely gone. Microsoft has left that space. But a lot of these things are going to the web. There's mint.com and there's some other opportunities that are available out there. But in these situations, again, you know, they could change on a dime. Access that you have today might not be the access that you have tomorrow. And that's another reason why we have to remind these companies to kind of keep us in the loop for when they're going to make these changes, that it's still available for the rest of us to be able to use.
And finally, in the grassroots effort, there is a new Facebook change for accessibility petition. When I signed it, there were like 33 signatures. It was worded pretty well. And you can get the link at serotalk.com if you wish to follow the route of petitions and ask Facebook. And maybe you could do that and follow up with your own personal email to the appropriate person if you desire. The Missouri couple who actually had their child taken away for the first 57 days and eventually were given custody of their daughter.
I'm not sure if I can talk about this and keep my blood pressure in a safe range. A couple had a child and the mother was breastfeeding her child for the first time, and there are definitely some challenges with that if you've never done it, and everybody has those challenges. Well, apparently the child began to turn blue, but the mother had already recognized what was going on and switched the baby to the other side, and everything was fine with the baby, but not so for those who were sort of watching for a misstep. And because of this, the social workers and hospital staff reported that this couple wouldn't be able to adequately care for their child because they were both blind and had no sighted assistance. And so for 57 days, that was the case. So they missed the first 2 months of their child's life because of something that really tends to happen to everyone. And this, I wish I could say this were an isolated incident, but I think some type of discrimination and concern on the part of the hospital staff happens quite often. And I don't know what we should do to change that, because let's think about it. If you're going into the hospital for a birth, this is a very joyous occasion, and it's also a very exhausting one. So it's difficult to have the strength to advocate for yourself right then when your life has just changed pretty dramatically. The hospital workers have been trained to watch for things like abuse and neglect, but what they don't seem to understand is that blindness does not equal bad parenting. So again, I don't know how we address this type of thing such that blind parents who do have the appropriate skills to be parents are not going to be questioned because they got a diaper on crooked the first time. But at the same time, recognizing the fact that just as is true for sighted parents, there are blind parents who can be a danger to their children, not because they're blind, but for other reasons. We have to have a way to protect children and at the same time protect the rights of blind parents.
It raised a lot of questions. You know, there were some different articles. I saw the NFB post that said that once we determined that the parents were fit, we hired an attorney for them, which raised a lot of flags in my mind, because I thought that sound, on the surface, that sounds fair. I want to make sure that they didn't have a drug problem. Or we had a story in the chat room the other night. You learned so much in the Serial Talk chat. But a story of a teacher who encouraged two blind high school students to get together. And of course, they had a child and neither one was really ready to take care of themselves, much less another child. So that's a real quagmire. I mean, to determine what skill set should someone have to be a parent, be it blind or not. Like someone said, there's no license.
There is no license. That's
parenting.
Right.
Made me wonder how often this happens that we don't know about. We've heard of a few success stories. Maybe once a year we hear about this happening and a happy ending. But I wonder how many unhappy endings are out there. And I'd certainly like to hear comments from people if you either know of someone other than the particular story we're talking about, but someone who was wrongfully denied access, or it may be a situation where it was the best thing that intervention took place.
You know, there's two things that come to my mind when working with employers and working with individuals in the community. One of the things, when you start explaining limitations of blindness and where they are, generally people personalize. And it comes down to education, kind of what Ricky was hitting on, because when you explain to somebody, they start thinking about, you're blind, you must play a musical instrument. You know, oh yeah, me, Stevie Wonder, and Ronnie Millsap all get together and we jam. You're dealing with the idea that if Aunt Gertie can't do it, then you can't do it. And that can come into play here too. And you have to educate the individual to understand that every parent has these problems, not just a blind one. The second thing I want to add really quickly, as bad as this is, and this is a terrible, tragic story, but it's even worse for those who want to adopt who are blind in several states. And going through that process can be very demeaning as well in trying to prove to the court or prove to a social worker that you can be a parent, exactly what you were saying a second ago. There is no license unless you want to adopt. And for some people in some states, other prejudices come into play, and it's even worse. So as much as I'm absolutely thrilled that these parents have come on the winning edge of this situation, and I'm sorry for what happened, it's even worse for those who are trying to raise a child and get that through the adoption system. So that's also something that I was thinking of when I heard this story.
No, you made a very good point that, you know, judgments about blindness are going to be based on the very first interaction that someone has. So this nurse decided that the mother was unfit, and you have to wonder, did she have a more negative experience with some other blind person? So stereotypes kick in. I adopted my wife's daughter and had to deal with a social worker making a determination whether I was fit. And her attitude and demeanor greatly changed when she saw me change my son's diaper, and just my interaction, and obviously the love I had with him, because changing diapers is such a bonding time. And that is why we as blind people have to be on our game at all times. When we're out traveling, the one person we meet is going to form their first impression. Not the ideal environment that we always have to be game on, but we have to be mindful that all things that we send cues about how things work. And
well, you have to be mindful that people are watching you, and what you choose to do about that is up to you, because I can say that there are times when we don't feel like being the ambassador to blind kind, but that doesn't change the fact that people are watching every move we make and making assumptions, erroneous or otherwise, about what our capabilities are. And in a hospital situation, just getting back to the story at hand, it's almost impossible to be thinking about how you're supposed to represent yourself and so on. What you really want to be thinking about at that point is getting to know your child and bonding with your child. And so I think that education is really the key, and it's something that you shouldn't have to deal with going into the hospital. It's something we shouldn't have to deal with at all, but that's not the reality. If we had education where nurses, social workers, hospital staff, or whatever, didn't just go through this sensitivity training or whatever they want to call it, but actually interacted with blind people, interacted with people in various situations to see how they truly do things, not having the nurse say, well, if I were blind, I couldn't do this because I can't even get to the bathroom in the dark.
That's a really good point. It's something that we used to have to work with new counselors on all the time, is don't make an assumption for the individual, because, you know, it was very easy for someone to go through some immersion training and then say, well, I could do it, why can't you? When that person has gone through a life-altering event, like Ricky was saying a second ago. At the same time, education can be a downside too. I can think of being on a plane and interacting with a flight attendant who did that international handicap speak where she raises her voice and slows her speech.
I can top that. Do you want some Brally?
Yeah.
Brally?
and then does all that kind of mimicking with her hands, that maybe not something that other people notice, that they're actually trying to do some mock sign language. I was sitting on a plane once with a CEO of a company, and this lady comes to me and goes, do you want something to drink? And he goes, oh, that is so embarrassing. I said, yeah, Miss Manners taught me to raise my pinky on drink. I mean, what do you do in order to work through something like that? We all have stories like that. Getting back to what Ricky was saying a second ago, it's hard to be the ambassador, but the second that you're not an ambassador means that the next person who really does need that assistance may not get it, because the experience that the person had previously was kind of poor, and they go, I went out of my way for that last guy, maybe I shouldn't have to do it this time. And again, experience. I can tell you one thing, that hospital won't make that mistake again. Hard not to get emotional about this one.
Great insights, and we'd certainly like to hear your thoughts. Resources at cerotalk.com. Sometime I will find the hot button and get 100 responses. I don't know what it'll be, but one of these days we're going to get inundated with more email or phone calls on one topic than we've ever had before. But anyway, we'd like to hear from you. A few things in the deals arena. We'd like to let you know of stuff, and of course, JJ and Matt over at Blind Bargains always let let us know of some cool stuff. Folks interested in the Olympus DM4, they found it for $269. That's at least $30 less than others are selling it for at $299. I'm still not sure that I want the device. Randy, Ricochet Randy, I call him there, at Accessible Devices. He'll have it in the lab and be able to play and do a review. Pat Ferguson did one that you can go through and listen to over at blindcooltech.com. Blind Bargains also found a copy of OmniPage 17. So if you want a mainstream scanning and reading OCR solution for $62 for Windows 7, you can certainly go that route. And also, Buddy lets us know that something we do want to review, an accessible, low-cost, but hopefully pretty high-quality recorder, the Zoom H1, has been delayed and now is looking to come out around August 20. We hope to review that product for you. Moving on to the security news, there's been a new Wi-Fi WPA2 vulnerability that's been found. You know, this has always kind of been thought to, well, you know, if you're WPA2, you're pretty good to go. You're pretty safe. Now, this one involves, I guess, that someone already be on the network and they can set up a portal to basically share all of the other traffic that's going on. So you can read that if you like at serotalk.com if you're paranoid about such things. I'm not as concerned realizing that someone already has to be on the network, but it certainly is an exploit. It's something we have to be mindful of, that no network is secure. Apple has improved their App Store security after 40. Granted, they would argue that's a low number based on their total number of users, but 40 credit cards were compromised by an app publisher who used it to get in to actually sell his books that he was selling. So now apparently what happens is if you log on from a second computer, you get 5 accounts in your iTunes. But if you come in with another computer, you will be prompted for some additional credit card information again. So that way it cannot be accessed by any other computer without you doing it. So that should pretty much lock it down, barring any kind of snooping software, any keylogger, anything like that. Ask you about this, Joe, because I only read one story. I know you follow this a little closer, but this talks about the ATM jackpotting, the Black Hat conference. So I might let you talk about what exciting developments came out of that event. But this one basically talked about a gentleman showed how he could basically get ATMs to just dump out the cash that was inside. And it's very important, because a lot of these skimmers that can be installed, and of course, you know, we've seen cameras installed underneath counters or up in the ceiling, you know, on the tiles, so that could monitor kind of what you're doing. And of course, even Clark Howard says, you know, the skimmers can be installed at the gas pump, so you really should go in and stand in line and make that extra effort. So I'm always concerned about the standalone ATM, but just generally, what did you see out of Black Hat that you thought was of interest?
The FBI grabbing those guys after the contest. You know, it's interesting that a big conference like Black Hat, which is all about hackery and finding ways to get around the system, is held in Las Vegas, which has got cameras all over it. So I'm always, you know, kind of surprised that A, you wanted to hold it there, and B, you would, you know, be surprised that the federal authorities aren't involved. Some of the things that come out of Black Hat that are famous is the blue pill, which was kind of the definition of the rootkit and how to take over not just Windows, but practically any operating system. Some other things that have happened in the past is they have a wall of shame, and it's an arch that you have to walk through, and it pings all your electronic devices and throws up all the information it can harvest from those devices as you walk through. Just so everybody knows, iPhones are usually grabbed 100% of the time. So there's something about each different year. This year seems to be a lot about intercepting cell phones and intercepting data from cell phones from 1,500 feet away. And that's kind of interesting because we're moving to mobile platforms as users. The desktop is becoming more of a commodity. And so more and more we're putting these devices into our hands with all this information, our banking information, our phone information, our history information, or even geolocation, because now we can see where you've been and where you go. And there's that wonderful website, pleaserobme.com, that talks about, you know, what are some ways to protect yourself from geotagging, because if you're on a fixed route, let's say you go back and forth to your office every day, there's a pattern that can be derived. Now, some people in security say, well, that's always existed. People could sit outside your house and case your house and know the same thing. But this goes a little further, because if you like hitting every third Thursday, you know, Subway, you know, someone can actually kind of really start to figure out a profile about you. Oh, this guy happens to like going to the bookstore or to this particular grocery store. And that's kind of what hacks are looking into now, is to get at this data that is just prevalent everywhere. But that's not to take away from the fact that the biggest hacks ever are social hacks. Those that are every time that you use your credit card at a restaurant, the waiter has the ability to go and make mass copies of it. Do a skimmer on the black lines on the back of your card right there in the restaurant, or take a photo of your numbers, which used to be a big thing about 6 years ago. There's another story that also comes to mind where a private security firm was hired to see if they could hack into a major bank in New York City. And what they did was they took 30 different flash drives and they left them in places like the bathroom and the subway station right outside the bank. And people picked up and went, ooh, free flash drive. And when they got into work, the first thing they did was plug it in to see what was on that flash drive. And in a matter of 15 minutes, about 12 of these devices had already logged in and were sending them back data through the network at the bank. It's just a situation where technology, and I'm not trying to scare anybody, believe me, that's not what I'm saying. You just have to be aware as a net user, as someone who is using this, because it's much easier for us now to buy things online and use the computer for much more of our banking than ever before. And so you just have to think about what you're doing and where you're going and make sure it's a known entity. That's what Black Hat really likes to concentrate on.
You could argue doing companies a favor by showing these exploits so that they can address it. And if they refuse to, shame on them.
That's Black Hat versus Gray Hat versus White Hat. It's its own subculture. I often promote that White Hat and Gray Hat are the way to go. Black Hat is specifically out for information wants to be free. And a really good version of that is looking at what's going on with WikiLeaks and whether that information was leaked for the public good or not. It gets very debatable. And that's what these conferences are about. Anybody who's interested, Slashdot is a great website for posting a lot of these things about what's coming out of Black Hat. That would be slashdot.com. As people remind me, it's not the greatest site for headers. So if you're someone who likes to do navigation by headings, you might want to just arrow key through a lot of those places. It's a very simple site. It's very easy to read, but can cause some confusion.
Definitely. On to the accessibility news. The ACB had attempted to, and of course, no fault of their own, they just didn't have enough broadband for Skype to work in the hotel where they were doing it. They conducted a presentation on July 10th. What is the future of screen readers and screen reading technology? Since Mike Calvo could not participate live via Skype, we made a post at blog.cerotech.com and also we got linked at cerotalk.com addressing the 10 questions that were put forth and some really good stuff to think about. Very well written, and I hope you'll check that out and give that some thought and maybe even post your comments in 2 cents, because it is an interesting time with the proliferation of portable devices. You know, how long will the Windows desktop be around? I guess a few years if we sold 150 million copies of Windows 7, but still, the technologies are changing, and where is screen reading technology going to keep up with that? Well, there's been a few new accessible games that have been put out. There's an accessible crossword puzzle I haven't played with yet.
For the accessible crossword puzzle, they actually have several other games as well. This is Blind Gamers. They've got Yahtzee and Boggle and a bunch of different types of solitaire. And what you do is you write these guys an email with your name and where you're from and an interest in getting this game, like the accessible crossword, which is free, by the way. And then they apparently send it to you. I just sent off my request this weekend, and hopefully I will have my game soon to talk about and perhaps review.
That would be awesome. A lot of folks are playing the new Monopoly, and I understand that they may have actually, because there's such high traffic, they may not actually be taking orders for a little while or allowing new persons to come on and play, but it wouldn't hurt, hopefully, to go ahead and submit your request if you wanted to play an online accessible game of Monopoly and play with other people around the world.
I like All in Play. They're kind of neat. And one of the things I want to get to now that I have more free time is Entombed. I've read Ricky's posts on it. I really am much more of a console gamer. I have enough usable vision that I can play games with static screens. I'm not like I'm a first-person shooter or, you know, driving simulator or anything like that. But there's a whole world of gaming now for the blind gamer that is just opening up. And I think it's great to go out there and support these guys. We all have to have reasons to kill time at the bus, and this is a wonderful way of doing so.
Are you going to jump on the new 360?
That thing is like so tempting. I'm hoping that Kinect will allow blind individuals to use the Xbox 360 with voice control and hand gestures a little bit. It may take still some memorization of going up a menu and to the right, you know, to get to Netflix, but I think it might be doable. I'm really interested in seeing where that's going.
Final thing in the accessibility front, there's a good article posted about the accessibility checker in Office 2010. So if you're creating documents that need to be accessible to the blind, low vision community, or maybe you can advise others who are in a position, you can give them this reference. It's a great URL, and we have it at serotalk.com for you. Finally, before we wrap up, I want to talk about new interesting audio that we have found. And I want to start first with Robert Carter, who published a presentation that he did for Bits on the accessibility of Apple. And he goes back to the beginning of it, back to 1990, and he plays where Steve Jobs talks about the improved speech and plays demos in 2006. It was nice to hear the applause from the crowd that appreciated the capability, whether they're Apple fanboys or just needed to use it. This is one of the very few things that you'll actually hear that come out of Bits, because the way that they work, and Bits is an organization of the ACB, and it's the Blind Information Technology Specialists, who have a policy of they bring together a lot of great content, but the only way to get to this protected content is to pay annual dues to be a member to do that. They do such a great job. They have a vendor showcase usually on Sunday afternoons. I think it's always been on Sunday afternoons since I've been there, and I've participated the last 3 years, I believe, and come up in different vendors, you know, everyone from APH and Freedom Scientific and GW and Serotech and everyone else. But again, no one gets to hear this great content. So I can respect what they're trying to do. Folks, it's time. I'm going to make a public plea to join all of the great folks out there. Accessible World, Accessible Devices, Serotalk, Blind Geek Zone, Mac Roundtable, so many great resources. People are putting out information. The blind community needs and deserves this information. Creative Commons here, folks. I believe you have a civic obligation to make this information available so that people can make informed and educated buying decisions and not going on secondhand flawed information or from rehab people that give you one option because that's all they know and all they plan to take the time to learn. People need choices to make informed decisions. You can still ask for donations. And I would argue you would actually get more donations and even a greater membership at large, even if people don't attend the conventions themselves, when people know what it is that you have to offer. And if you can't go that far, at least share the information with Main Menu. Get the information out to the masses. You do good work putting this stuff together. Don't keep it in a closed shell.
I was going to say, I would agree with your take on submitting donations and possibly getting even more members to Bits and other organizations who do this type of thing by making this information available, because people tend to want to contribute to the things that they find useful. And I, for example, would donate to Bits and other organizations like this as they provide information to the community at large. And I think that people would be surprised at just what kind of response one can get by making information open to the community. There may be people who have no idea that some of these organizations even exist, whereas posting something that is coming from one of these organizations and has a sort of tagline, this took place during a meeting held at the convention or what have you, people will say, wow, I didn't even know they had such a thing. I want to become a member. I want to be a part of that.
It's not just ACB. I don't want to look all one-sided here. The NFB does this as well. Computer science. I ran from the exhibit hall to go pay my $5 to make sure that I could get the MP3s of this year's computer science division meetings. I recorded the ones for the assistive technology trainers division. And that's another thing that I want to make sure everybody understands is that with the proliferation of MP3 recorders and accessible ones at that, this information is going to be harder and harder to keep inside. Unless you're going to pull a Steve Jobs moment where everybody has to shed their devices as they walk in or put your laptops on the floor, it's going to be very difficult moving forward for anybody to keep this information internal. Like I said before with hacking, information wants to be free. So why not go ahead and give that out?
Capitalize on it.
Or better yet, make it time sensitive. Those who did come to Phoenix, those who did come to Dallas, here you go. You get first crack at this. Try not to put it in your Dropboxes and share with everybody. Here it is. And in 3 months later, we release it to main menu or whomever wants to be able to use this information, because for archiving purposes, sometimes it's good to go back to what was said 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, especially in the operating system talks I've done in the past, for references and going back to see what was said. And maybe the guest speaker at that time said one thing, but 2 years later changed their mind and decided to say something different. It's for the community that we're making this request.
You can keep it confidential and people will step in with the recorders and transmit WMAs over Twitter, or you can share it and bring in new members and new revenue streams and marketing. Certainly you have costs, and that's understandable. No one would dispute, you know, asking for donations to make it happen. On the NFB National Convention, there are some audio highlights that they've made available, as the ACB has made their recordings of their general sessions available. And again, one more quick rant on that. They have them in 4-hour blocks. I'm glad you've got the stuff available, but please remember that people will not listen or queue through 4-hour blocks of audio, or they might try to listen to it real-time streaming and then have it break 2 hours in and not finish. So we would ask the management there of the radio program to go through it and pick out some of the highlights and make those available either in individual sections or 30-minute blocks or something, just because I know ACB, you know, is really striving to improve their membership base. But again, people need to know what you're doing. They need to hear the president's message as its own audio file, or the scholarship winners, or the NLS presentation. You know, people need to know what you do before they're going to come out and support. There was a CNN blind driving story. When we hear it through other vehicles, no pun intended, it's strictly, yeah, we're going to set this up and blind folks are going to drive, and maybe even someone's going to actually go from Baltimore to Orlando next year. This story, I thought, was the best take on it, because it said that realistically, even if it should ever happen, it's going to be years down the road. But the greater goal here is, by setting such a high goal as this, you're going to create electronics, sensing, and communication tools that can be added to a lot of in-home appliances and other technologies to make them accessible. So from that standpoint, I can really sign on, whereas otherwise I might sit out on the fence like a lot of other people, saying, aren't there more important things to worry about, like blind people driving, like actual employment and living skills and braille proficiency? And
your first point about the spinoff technology reminds me of the space program, when we tried to justify, you know, why did we go to the moon, as somebody rips off Velcro from their belt and heats something up in their microwave oven. And this is a segment I've joked with Michael about creating, where Mr. Calvo and I get into a steel cage. We battle it out, because Mr. Calvo feels very strongly about this, and I feel very much in a different direction on this, because I don't think this is going to happen in my lifetime. I've said that publicly. There's just so many aspects to driving that are hard to fathom since we don't do it. My wife has cited, I pay for the car and I ride in the car. Even when I had better vision, I was in my teen years when I decided that I never wanted to drive, because there was so much concentration that was needed. If you've got people driving with KFC doubled down in their hands, who shouldn't be driving, they should be eating and driving, or texting, or talking on a cell phone, or the kids are acting up in the bad, all that's going to be for the blind driver as well. Distractions are a big thing. I'm just not really convinced that this thing is there, and I think it's more of a publicity stunt. What was the big thing that we needed to knock down? Text, books, being able to read text and books. We've pretty much mastered that for the most part. We're doing really well in that arena. So what would be the next big thing to rally people around? And that would be transportation and mobility. And I'm reminded of a Twitter comment made by Mr. Jeff Bishop, who said, who's the first to create blind driver's insurance? Allstate, Geico. Imagine what the cost of that's going to be initially. If we're talking earlier about issues with blind parenting, imagine what people are going to feel about blind driving. And about the time we do have blind cars, the flying car will be out and we'll want that too. So again, sand in a colander. We'll never catch up.
We talked about that years ago. By the time they figure out how the blind can drive, they will have figured out how to create artificial eyesight.
Imagine blind driving schools. That's going to be awesome. Think of the world of accessories. Cup holders and water bowl holders for your guide. There's all sorts of marketing potential here, now that I sit here and think about it a little bit.
Well, one person said they had the dog get in the back, and I'm like, wait a minute. And that dog be perched up in the passenger side? I think he or she could be
out the window,
If we'd be offering some valuable insights, you know, barking to the left, barking to the right.
The same way that if you push the window twice on the window, it automatically rolls down your window for drive-thrus. There should be just pushing it once allows you to get enough for your guide's head through the window kind of thing.
There you go.
Or can't you safely have the dog on the roof and it does the gestures?
Oh, there you go.
Until it smells Arby's over there and says, that's where we're going now.
Blind driver crashes through the front of Arby's.
I found the park.
I don't care if it's Windows, Macintosh, or Linux. I don't trust my life in the hands of an operating system. I haven't seen one that stable.
Yeah, okay.
Now who's being pessimistic?
I agree completely with that.
I know Linux. I know people have had it up for 2 years, but I don't want to be there that 2 years in 1 minute.
People don't send their Braille displays in to be cleaned on a regular basis. How are they going to maintain vehicles? You know, I know a lot of sighted individuals that don't take care of their car currently. And where do you get the money to pay for that? I mean, a car is expensive. I don't care who you are.
And it's not even just about your driving skill. It's about the lack of skill that every other sighted driver has. Well, maybe not every other sighted driver, but if you've ever ridden with my husband, which none of you have, the cursing and the freaking out is just amazing.
That's right, defensive.
People are so ridiculously stupid when they're driving.
How does a computer compensate defensively for the idiocy of other people who are just in a hurry or talking on their phones and not paying attention and running lights? What a great recruitment. You know, most people are losing their vision, and wow, if I got to decide what to do, I could join this NFB because they're going to find a way for me to drive. A few other audio things, and we don't talk about FS a lot, and I guess that would be understandable, but Jonathan Mosen did a great interview with a gentleman who is totally blind, going for psychiatry, and I thought it was a very interesting interview. Jonathan was on his game as far as asking great questions, and Tim, who's in the process of getting a dog, explained very eloquently a lot of prejudice and different issues that he's had to deal with and how he had to kind of prevent negativity from other people from affecting him so that he could go forth and accomplish his goals. And he should be wrapping that up in the next year or so. And he spoke at the NFB, and I'm sure it was a very moving and interesting presentation. So we'd actually encourage you to go listen to the latest FS Cast.
In my experience with working with many people trying to become doctors of any kind, be that, you know, in psychiatry or psychology or any of the medical fields, you have a lot of people who analyze for a living. This guy has had to not only undergo this from administrators who are looking at it for malpractice, but he's also having to do it with every teacher he walks up to. They're using their tools of their trade on this guy, and he has to insulate himself professionally and emotionally.
Okay, Joe, why don't you give your blog?
Read my blog at therangerstation.blogspot.com. That's all one word, therangerstation.blogspot.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at rangerstation. That's www.twitter.com/rangerstation.
And you can check us out at twitter.com/serotalk, or just get in the habit of going to serotalk.com, or of course the official Serotech blog is at blog.serotech.com. I say we move on here with the fun. I thank both you, Ricky and Joe, and of course send us your suggestions, resources at serotalk.com, or the infamous blab line. We want to hear you blab blah 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 blah. 866-997-2522.
See you in a couple of weeks, folks.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com, or leave us a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB-2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all the internet and life has to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.